The next train to depart from platform 5 will be the 1400 train to Aberdeen, calling at York, Darlington, Newcastle, Berwick-on Tweed, Edinburgh Waverley, Haymarket, Cooper, Lookers, Dundee, Arbroath, Montrose and Aberdeen.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Works Oral History Podcast. This series is called The Train at Platform 5, an oral history of King's Cross rail workers. A team of researchers interviewed 25 people who worked at this busy London railway terminal to document what life was like working at the station for drivers, guards, pantry boys, station staff and more. In episode 2, we look at how workers started out and how they got the skills for their work, their stories from across their station, as well as on board the trains. We hope you enjoy it.
Rewinding back to the 60s, pay was pretty appalling. But the idea was that if you worked all the hours God sent, and particularly on Sundays, but you got premium payments, then, you know, you've got a reasonably sustainable income.
My first days were mainly going around cleaning engines, getting very oily rags and wiping down boilers and front of the locomotive, in the cabs, the motions, wheels, you name it, any part of the engine, we had to clean it.
As a cleaner, you just follow the lads that are doing the job. As far as you've got a foreman there, and they follow the lads as far as that was concerned. As I say, I started at 15, so I couldn't go onto the footplate until I was actually 16. I wasn't allowed to, so I was actually on the shed. I was doing different between cleaning and shed labour and that sort of thing, as far as that was concerned.
They signed me up as a railman, which is like the bottom grade. Being a railman meant you were engaged in servicing the trains in King's Cross as they sort of finished their journey. So it was part of the cleaning gang, and it was, the cleaning gangs were sort of defined by gender really. It was the women mostly worked on the inside of the carriages and the men worked on the outside. We would be cleaning windows or picking up the rubbish at the end of the doors, the litter and everything. Or else we'd be down on the track side with long brooms with washing the windows and filling up the toilet tanks and the restaurant car tanks.
I was called a pantry boy, and basically my basic job on the East Coast Main Line was washing up. I became very good at washing up, and still am. I spent about 4 years washing up, and I think I was the best washer-upper on the East Coast. I definitely think that, yeah. My glasses shone and everything was clean.
The inquiry office is brilliant because the inquiry office, as I said, is a nursery for the railway, really. Because it's where you go, especially if you're going to be a clerical officer in the front row, it's where you learn the routes, you learn how to read the timetables, how to calculate fares and everything else, and actually interact with the public without being in a face-to-face role, since over the telephone. So the very first phone call I took was absolutely horrendous, really, from I thought at the time, but it's funny now. And I was expecting, they sit down and they said, right, take your first call. And I was thinking, oh, they're going to ask me how much it is for a fare to Leeds or the next train to Edinburgh. It'll be fine, keep calm. And so I answered the phone and this guy just said to me, how much is it to put a pigeon on the train to Tipton?
Tricia joined us in 1979, Tricia Roach. She was the first female in the footplate grade since the Second World War. And there was quite some resistance to her coming into the footplate grade at King's Cross. Management were a bit worried about it because they didn't think they had any facilities, etc. And there was a bit of a kickback from some of the older drivers.
So it was this peculiar situation of the people that I actually worked with, the drivers, would go out of their way to help me. But there were a lot of people that wouldn't work with me. I'd come into work and I thought I was working with one driver, and in fact, the foreman would say, oh no, you're with driver such and such today.
A little bit surprising. I mean, you've got these guys that are sort of 60, 65, and they said, I'm very worried about being in a cab on my own, you know, with a young female, because she might ravish me.
I think I was really lucky that I made my approach for a job at King's Cross, because at King's Cross, both the NUR at that time and ASLEF were very strong. The union, who showed their support to me from day one, really was something that was vital.
It was a different era at that time. You know, people could pass remarks, joke, say certain things and get away with it. And they really got away with, a lot, because I could be walking and somebody would just come and knock my backside and then say, oh, you got big backside, you know. And then you can't report to anybody, because even the managers, they said, oh, it's a joke. Oh, you can't take a joke and that kind of thing.
Yes, I got a supervisor's role. And when I got it, the cleaners, bearing in mind, majority of the cleaners were black anyway, they all came up and said, great, congratulations, congratulations, congratulations. I says, why? They says, you've done it. I've been put on a pedestal here. They're looking at me, they're watching me, because it's the first time we've had a female supervisor on the station, and not only female supervisor, a black female supervisor on the station. But then it opened gates, because other female thought, if Rachel can do it, they can do it.
I worked at Top Shed, which was the shed allocated to King's Cross. It all came under the King's Cross umbrella, but it was a large shed which we were governed by a shed master. That's an old-fashioned title nowadays, isn't it? The shed master, who was an ex-engineer, and then we had outside foremen that placed the engines after they came on the shed, turned, watered, cold, had their fires cleaned, smoke box cleaned. Then they would put them in position for the way they would leave the shed. So they're all set in order. So that's where I started life. When the last steam engine went, Top Shed closed down and was razed to the ground. And then we all migrated down to King's Cross.
I go up into the signal box. We're surrounded by our 80-foot long horseshoe-shaped control panel. And the trains are red lights with identity numbers on little screens popping around along the tracks. And you're confronted then with the panorama of the whole show, with five signalmen working, station announcer almost directly in front of you, looking at the King's Cross control end of the panel.
We're working directly with the signalmen. And, the King's Cross signalman was right in front of me, and then the supervisors were at the side of me. Most of the men that had come into the signal box had men who were men who had been used to working outside boxes. You know, so they worked on their own sort of thing, you know. They found it a bit difficult coping with a crowd of people all in the same room, because it was taking them out of their comfort zone, basically.
But King's Cross was all electric and had 232 miniature levers about this size to operate everything between the platforms and the tunnel and just out the other side of the tunnel.
I don't want to upset any of you English people, but they found that Irish, Northern Irish and Scottish voices carried better over the PA system.
When I started, the kitchen cars we had were 1928 vintage, but they were very, very, very old and very worn out by 1959. I had two fire buckets, which I were loined from various places, and I used to go up on the engine and get hot water off the engine. And I come back one day and I put one of my buckets of water in my washing up to wash up, and when I turned around, the chef had stolen the other one and he was making the afternoon tea for the passengers. I just hope there was no coal dust in this one. One of the things that I learned very quickly was that there were certain bits of track on the East Coast Main Line that were not quite as good as they should be because they'd still been damaged during the war. Three in particular, one the other side of Benton. Most of the chefs used to come out the kitchen when you got to this junction because the train used to rock about. We were vacuum brakes in them days. When the driver put the brake on, if you put it on full, you stopped in a big heap, basically. So you'd be hanging on to things in the cupboards and making sure nothing fell out. And in them days, lunch was 9 and 6 pence, dinner was 10 and 6 pence, and they were four-course meals. There was a soup or juice or grapefruit or something, then a fish course, then a main course, then a sweet or cheese and biscuits. So it was quite a big meal. You find on some of the trains, like at the 1 o'clock from London, we used to go to Edinburgh on that, people would come in and have lunch. They'd come and have afternoon tea, which was toast, tea cake, sandwiches, coffee. And then they'd come back later on and have dinner. I mean, you can imagine when I went home to see my mum, I said, what these people eat, it's unbelievable. They eat more in a day than I got in a week. There was jointed rail in them days, 65-foot length of rail, so you've got the clickety-click, clickety-click, which we used to like as youngsters because you could work out how fast you were going. So many clicks in a minute meant you were doing X amount of miles an hour. We had to come back overnight from Edinburgh on the sleepers, and I'd fall asleep and wake up, and then just the noise of the track and certain bumps and things, and oh yeah, we're just running into York, I know where this is, yeah, without opening my eyes.
I was a relief supervisor, and I covered all the supervisors, all the supervisory posts. It's train movements, platform supervisors, cleaning supervisor, senior ticket supervisor. My last job was having to shunt the Royal train into perfect position.
Of course, one of the most important things was to measure it all out to make sure that the train stopped dead centre where the red carpet was, because my God, it was hanging a fence if you got that wrong.
Now, when you think his coach was at the back of train, I'm at the front trying to give hand signals to the driver and listening to my colleague on the radio saying, bit more, all right, that's it, yeah. Then I've got to give the driver the red signal.
Early years, I worked as a guard. And the guard, what we did was we were doing tickets. We were doing customer services on the train. We sell tickets. Safety is priority. In case there's derailment or anything like that, you had the skills to be able to connect the trains together or uncouple the trains.
Before the departure of the train, I always used to make the announcement, which, you know, some people found funny. They used to have tetras. I used to say, anybody found hiding in the toilet will be flushed out. Like sometimes some people used to pretend that they didn't speak English. And I say, okay, no worries. And like the person who would say that he doesn't speak English, I say, excuse me, is that your fiver on the floor? What? I say, you can speak English, can't pay up.
If the train is delayed, you get quite a lot of abuse. And, you know, at times people become personal. They say all sort of things. But, you know, you have to take it.
I used to get 5% commission on any ticket I sold. And one day I was working this train from Newcastle, and we had this man and his son get on the train. And I went up to him and I said, ticket. Oh, I need to buy a ticket. So I sold him the ticket. And I said, what about the boy? Oh, he's only 4. No, I'm 7. Shut up, you 4. I said, you have to buy the ticket.
The toilet was locked, and I knocked. Nobody answered. So I said, okay, then I have to open the toilet. They think that we can open the toilet because they've locked it inside. So I opened the toilet with my key. And there, two lovers were at it. I closed the door and I said, hurry up and come out. And then they came out. I told them, okay, you are using my toilet as a hotel. You could have waited until you got in home, but you haven't. So I'm charging you £20, you know, for bread and breakfast. I'll give you a cup of tea, and then you can, you've already used the toilet. So they were in a hurry. they brought the £20 out, and then the guy gave me £10 in addition. Oh, I apologize, blah, blah, blah. I said, no, that's all right. But I gave the money back to them.
The line of promotion, which governs all footplate men, the grades go in order of cleaner. You pass the exam and become a past cleaner. Then you become a second man. Then you pass a driving exam to become a past second man. And then finally you're appointed as a driver. All done strictly on seniority from the day you join the railway. So that's the order of progression.
Initially, we had a 2-week course. This was basically about how to keep yourself safe in a working environment such as we were in, but also how to fire to an engine, how to shovel coal. They didn't take us on an engine. All they had was a big bin at the side with a fire hole door welded to it and a small bunker of coal, and we had to practice getting the coal, swinging it and putting it into this metal box in the different locations where it needed to go. And I can remember the first session, by the time we finished, there was more coal on the platform than there was in the box. And we all thought, ouch, this is more difficult than we thought.
Well, the training was really, you went with a experienced fireman for a couple of weeks to get used to the idea of how you handled the pickaxe, the shovel, the fire irons, and then you were virtually on your own with a driver. As a fireman, your job was mainly to get the engine ready. So you'd make sure the coal bunker was full, the water tank was full, and there was a fire in the fire hole. It wasn't dead. And then you'd gradually fill the firebox up with coal, so that you've got a fire going really well in it.
You've got water troughs with the mainline engines. You used to drop a scoop when you approach the trough, and the scoop takes up the water into the water tank.
The longest job we had at King's Cross was to York and back in 8 hours. Now that was nearly 200 miles there, nearly 200 miles back. That would be round about 9 to 10 tons of coal and just one fireman.
There was a men's barber shop and a ladies barber shop on the train. Yeah. Much to the annoyance of the firemen, because every time they put a cinema coach on or a barber shop, it was another coach. And of course, that was another half a ton of coal they would have to shovel.
Because you're shoveling something like a ton of coal an hour on an express, not too many drivers would let you do the driving, because they would have to do the shoveling. What I liked about the diesels coming along at that time was that meant that I could share the driving, something that never happened on steam engines.
A driver I knew called Freddie Orr, who was there when I was there, and his dad was a driver as well. And his dad used to yearn for the old days, so probably back before the Second World War, where you would drive up to Newcastle and the driver would pass his driver's bag to the fireman, as it was then. Right? Because obviously you were lodging in Newcastle, and you were staying in a hotel, so the driver would have to take his bag with all his bits and pieces, and he would pass his bag to the fireman. The fireman would then take the fireman's bag and the driver's bag and get off of the engine, by which time the guard will have arrived from the back of the train, and the fireman would then give his bag and the driver's bag to the guard, and the guard was expected to follow along almost 3 steps behind them, because that was the kind of hierarchy that they'd established.
I remember looking up to the elder drivers. They were gods. They were absolute gods, because these guys had fired on steam. And then they'd gone on to the diesels in the late 60s, you know. And I remember just admiring these guys.
As a second man,
basically the highest paid tea boy that was ever on the railway to a certain extent, because you make drivers tea, but you get down on the phone to the signalman for the driver and say we're detained at. If you had to couple up two locomotives, that was the second man's job for a double header.
Most of the trains were heated by steam boilers. So although we had diesel engines, to heat the trains, there was a blooming great big boiler squeezed into the engine room. Right? And our job as driver's assistants was to set the boiler going, make sure the steam was going through the train. We would couple and uncouple at times if we were in yards, but not at King's Cross, because we had chances to do that. If the boiler broke down, we'd have to attend to the boiler. And you teamed up, so you sometimes had a regular driver for maybe 6 months. So you got to know each other very well. You became a really close-knit couple, almost like an uncle and nephew kind of relationship.
I started in 1978. I did 6 years as a driver's assistant, and in them 6 years, you just watched the driver. You watched him. And it was a form of an apprenticeship. When he had confidence in you, he let you have a go. And for them to let you have a go, wow, that was like winning the lottery. You know, you're driving this big trainer, for example, like a Class 55 Deltic, which really they only run on our line on the East Coast. And I remember sitting there driving this train under his instruction, and I'm thinking, 20 years old, I'm driving this 500-ton train with people asleep on it because they were the overnight sleepers from London to Doncaster, and I'm thinking, wow.
After all the practical experience that I got through the drivers, I then went on a training course, something that was called MP12. And that was a 6-month training course where you learn everything. I mean, literally everything. The railway rule book was really thick.
People would ask you if you'd passed your exams the first or second time. You got 3 goes at it. It was very extraordinary to pass on the third time, because usually that would mean you weren't going to pass at all. Most people pass second time.
And in 1984, the steam heating kind of died off. So the second man's job was arguably becoming obsolete. And that was the time that I passed out for driving.
We used to have things called diagrams, right? And what basically a diagram is, it's your daily worksheet. So you pick up your diagram and it will say, take a light engine from King's Cross to Finsbury Park, leave that engine there, pick up another engine, go to Fern Park, pick up some empty coaches, bring them into King's Cross. They tell you what to do for the day. And they tell you all the timings of what you should do. And then all these diagrams, and there were hundreds of them just for King's Cross.
It was all done on the footplate through going up through the different links. A link is simply a group of work going from the little shunt jobs at the bottom to the Newcastle jobs at the top. And usually, every time you moved up, you got either a better quality of work or a little bit more money, or if you're lucky, a bit of each.
Because if you can imagine a train driver on the suburban like Hartford North Loop, they go backwards and forwards, and doing 150 stops a day, and it can be pretty tedious. And most people didn't like those kind of jobs. But if you're doing a Newcastle return or a Leeds return, you're belting up the main line. You only maybe stop 3 or 4 places. So it's a more relaxed work on the main line.
We had a huge freight terminal at King's Cross with about 8 different locomotives punching wagons up and down it. And then we started getting short trip jobs outside. And then you get your first passenger train, local suburban train. And it just went on and on as you progressed up through the links. It was done on seniority.
It gives you something to look forward to, getting up to the top link eventually and earning loads of money. So you came there with that in mind, that start at the bottom, eventually you'll get to the top and you'll be earning good money.
Well, for one, when you passed out, you felt great because you're in charge of your own train. And as long as you followed the rules and regulations, nobody troubled you. And the first trip was a bit daunting because I did an afternoon shift on my own. And half was in the daylight and half was at night. And night driving was a little bit different from day. But as you got on, you just became used to it.
Thank you for listening to the second episode of the Train at Platform 5. This podcast was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. The project was set up and run by Arts, Education and Heritage Specialist Digital Works, who worked with Camden Local Study Centre. To find out more about our history projects, including documentary films, podcasts and to listen to the full unedited interviews for this project, please visit www.digital-works.co.uk. Please join us for the third and final episode, where we explore more stories from King's Cross Station.